Hi, everyone, and welcome to Raven Reviews Election 2016, weekly interviews on six crucial topics. The Raven Foundation is presenting in-depth explorations of big issues that aren't being discussed in mainstream election coverage. We've already discussed Christian support of Nazi Germany with historian Bob Erickson, racism with Melvin Bray, and democracy, violence, and the risks of tyranny with political theorist Paul Dumichel. You can see all of those interviews at the Raven Foundation. In the next few weeks, we'll talk about politics, violence, and Islam, and our final interview will be on politics, scapegoating, and healing our nation. But today, I'm so excited because we have Brian McLaren with us. Hi, Brian.
Hi, great to be with you, Adam.
Well, thanks so much for being here. Brian is an author of many books, including Generous Orthodoxy. And Brian, I don't believe in book jackets, so I throw them away. But this was the book, Generous Orthodoxy, that really introduced me to you. And I read it in 2004, and I was so young, but I still took notes. thank you for this book. It's fantastic. And I still look back to it and think how it makes me a much more generous person and human being and Christian. So thank you for that one.
Well, that's good to know.
And you've also written other fantastic books, Everything Must Change, A New Kind of Christianity, Why Did Jesus, Moses, the Buddha, and Muhammad Cross the Road? Important for our conversation today about politics, Brian has written The Word of the Lord to Democrats and its companion, The Word of the Lord to Republicans, which are both fictional accounts that kind of explain politics and opening and expanding our view of politics. I remember those coming out last election cycle, right?
That's right.
And it just, you have a way of calming things down in these hyper crisis moments. And so thank you for those books as well.
Well, thanks. I'm just thinking the one, The Word of the Lord to Republicans, the main, one of the characters in that book has an eerie resemblance to the Republican nominee this time around. So nobody has accused me of prophecy yet, but anyway.
You saw that one coming. Yeah. you've also written, you've also helped write a new voter's guide for Chalice Press called Progressive Christians Voter's Guide, which people can download on chalicepress.com. Brian's latest book, which we will talk about more today, is called The Great Spiritual Migration. And I kept the book jacket just for our conversation. But now I'm going to throw it away because I don't believe in those things. So they just get in the way. Brian is also an influential speaker at conferences throughout the world and has mentored countless pastors, church planters, and bloggers. Brian is what the kids today call kind of a big deal, but you wouldn't know it because one of the best things about Brian is his kindness and his humility. So Brian, it's an honor to have you here. Thank you for talking with us today about the great spiritual migration and about politics. Before we get into our discussion, I want people to know in the chat room that Suzanne, my colleague here at Raven, is in the chat room. She'll be monitoring it and coming in when she has questions or comments to ask. So thank you for doing that, Suzanne. So Brian, thank you for another excellent book. It's timely. And as with all of your books, you talk about serious topics and provide great information, but you also tell wonderful stories and have this refreshing sense of humor that run throughout your books. And I want to get to that humor first because I feel like I need it in this stressful kind of crisis political climate. I mean, when you write about standing under a tree in an African zoo to avoid the rain and discovering that it's not rain that's falling on you, but fruit bats are pooping on you. My inner third grade just thinks that's just hilarious. So what is it about a sense of humor during these critical moments that's important, do you think?
Well, I mean, first of all, during this election season, imagery of fecal matter falling on us from the sky, that might have a special a relevance. But putting that aside, we really do need a sense of humor at times like these. Obviously, incredibly serious matters of life and death on so many levels being discussed. But then you see the kind of cavalier attitude by people who are only motivated for their team to win and for the other team to lose. That deserves laughter. It deserves mockery. It deserves disdain. But also, I think sometimes we also have to almost rise to a higher level, have some faith that in the long run, the power of good and the power of love will win, which maybe helps us not take some of this temporary insanity quite so seriously.
Yeah. Having a sense of humor is so important. I often hear people say, I just don't have a sense of humor. Is a sense of humor something you can work on? Is it something that you're just born with?
it's funny you say that because I'm married. My wife her name is Grace, and Grace is an amazing, wonderful person and my best friend and my compatriot, through life and companion through life. But man, she doesn't get jokes. And one of the funniest things in the world is to tell her a joke and watch how she doesn't get it. I mean, she gets it. She just doesn't think it's funny. So I do think there are some people who, some of those genes just didn't quite make it in the DNA splicing or something. But I think all of us have to have ways that we can de-intensify. I was a pastor for 24 years and I did a lot of marriage counseling. And one of the things you find out in marriage counseling is that if people are excessively serious, they stay stuck. And there's some ability to sort of step back, have a laugh at yourself, not take yourself so seriously, that makes it possible for us to move forward, And so the ability to escape from excessive seriousness, I think, is a paralyzing seriousness is tremendously important on personal levels and I think on political levels too. By the way, that's one of the reasons why so many of us are lamenting that Jon Stewart is not on the air with us these days, but we're grateful for Trevor Noah and Stephen Colbert and others who give us a chance, and Saturday Night Live, they give us a chance to laugh about and de-intensify the seriousness.
Yeah, Jon Stewart did an excellent job of bringing humor to politics, and yeah, he's greatly missed. Yeah. But let's get into the seriousness of the situation, but not get paralyzed by it. Yeah, I like that a lot. So there's one particular passage in your book that really points to the dire moment in human history. You write that the extractive and consumptive way of life that we have created will not stand. We are headed for self-destruction, and our destructive way of life needs more than minor tweaking, more than modest incremental change. It is time for a great spiritual migration to a new way of life, supported by a new kind of Christian faith. I mean, that quote speaks to almost apocalyptic urgency in our times. How urgent do you think the moment is in human history?
Well, here's what's one of the things you have to either laugh or cry at in this election. A lot of us think that the environmental crisis is one of the most serious crises that the human race has ever faced. It's not our fault, but we inherited a way of powering our entire economy, our entire civilization that uses fossil fuels. And in our lifetime, we found out that those fossil fuels were throwing our climate out of balance, and that we've crossed key thresholds now that are going to lead to the polar ice caps melting and things like the Gulf Stream being disrupted, and we're facing all kinds of huge challenges relating to climate. And in this election, it's hardly been mentioned. Donald Trump doesn't believe climate change is real. He says that it's a hoax invented by China to slow down the American economy. But obviously, you know, all thinking people who pay attention to the data know that it is real. But here's where this becomes really interesting for someone like me, a committed Christian activist. If we're going to change our relationship with the earth from what I call, in that quote you mentioned, an extractive economy, if we're going to change that, it's going to require a change in values. And a change in values is something that we normally look at religion to help us achieve, you know. And this is where we need spiritual communities, faith communities, to be mobilized to address the deeper values issues that underlie that dimension of our crisis. I should probably add, Adam, that obviously that's not the only important issue. We have this deep-seated racial blindness among white people in our country. We have white privilege and white supremacy encoded in our system, and we really need to address it. Again, this is a matter of great importance because an unjust and unsustainable society is it's going to have to face the consequences for its wrongdoing. And so you put all of these things together and you see this is a time when people of faith and people of moral conscience, they can't just get lulled to sleep by the circus the media circus that this election's been.
You are a great model of someone who has these conversations with people with whom we disagree. You bring up Trump as being a climate change denier. I have, and I'm sure people listening have people in their family who deny climate change too. I just had a conversation with somebody in my family and I was like kind of dumbfounded. Like, as you say, if you just look at the evidence, it's there. But I didn't know how to respond to this person in my family, in part because I wanted to keep the peace. But also, how do you have these conversations with people, not just like the abstract Donald Trump out there, but the people that are close to you in our family, the people that we love?
Yeah. Well, you know, the first thing I've learned is here's where a little bit of humor and lightheartedness can come in and be helpful. So if I were to be talking to a relative or a neighbor, as happens where I live quite often, who doesn't believe in climate change, I might just sort of, you know, put a smile on my face, sit back and say, you know, wow, I see that differently. And in other words, instead of saying, you're wrong, you know, what's wrong with you? Don't you believe in science? You know, getting into a kind of attack. Well, when you attack people, it makes them feel defensive. And I think a kinder and in the long run, more effective way to bring about change is to make what I call a powerful non-directive statement. In other words, I'm not telling you what to do. And I'm doing nothing regarding you. I'm simply defining myself, you know, wow, I see that differently. Now, having a bald head really helps, you know, to make the point there, but, just to define myself. And then very often people say, well, what do you mean? And I'll then say, well, you know, I don't really need to go into it. I just need you to know, I see that very, very differently. Mm-hmm. And if they're really interested, I might say, well, you know, ask me about it next week or something, and I'll be glad to talk about it because I don't want to get into an argument right now. You see, the ability to differ without having to persuade you that I'm right is a tremendous gift that we can give to people. And so that's one thing I would say. I'll tell you another thing, Adam, especially in this issue of climate change. I'm involved with a wonderful organization called Eco America, and they have a special division of what they do related to faith called Blessed Tomorrow. And they've actually done quite a bit of research on what helps climate change deniers to change. And one of the things that research tells us is that if you say to a person, you give them 10 reasons why they should accept the validity of climate change, there's something in the human brain that's called complexity bias. If I have a simple lie and you offer me a complex truth, complexity bias will make me emotionally prefer my simple lie to your complex truth. So what that would mean then is the smartest thing we could do is just give one or two very simple facts that wouldn't complexify the person's life and just lets them know that there's another way to see this.
Reminds me, and I know you've read this book too, Jonathan Haidt's The Righteous Mind. Yes. Talks about that quite a bit. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, let's get into the new kind of Christian faith that's in that quote. You state that Christians need to migrate in three primary ways. So let's take those three ways one by one. First, you state that we need to migrate from a system of correct beliefs to loving, compassionate ways of life. So like the first question that comes to my mind is, what are the dangers of beliefs when it comes to loving others? And also, I don't have the book jacket for this either, but why did Jesus, Moses, the Buddha, and Muhammad cross the road? Is this refreshing book about beliefs? And so it's not that you're wanting to do away with beliefs, but move them kind of in a different direction that leads us to loving others in a better way.
Yeah. So look, if John Calvin were my Lord and Savior, or if St. Thomas Aquinas were the Messiah, it might be different. But if we're in a religion that purports to follow Jesus of Nazareth, Jesus' focus, this is pretty hard to disagree with. Jesus' focus was not on saying, we've got this system of beliefs called Judaism. Let's throw it out and we're going to bring in a new system of beliefs that we're going to name after me and a new religion called Christianity. It's just not what Jesus does. What Jesus does is proposes to people that there's a new way of life that's possible and that people need to change their way of thinking to embrace that new way of life. That's what that word repent means. And the word follow me suggests that he's setting an example that he's inviting us to observe and imitate. You know, that's what that word follow really means. It means a positive kind of imitation. And when he's asked what that way of life is about, what's the greatest commandment? What's the prime moral directive? Jesus says, not perfect your system of beliefs and then everything will logically flow from there. But rather he says love. And he does something very, very profound and very powerful. He says, not just have the right ideas about God, the right conceptions of God. He says, love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. So interestingly, love is really at the core. And then what he does is he says, and the second commandment, in other words, but you can't just get away with loving God. You also have to love your neighbor as you love yourself. And to say the second is like it is a way of saying the second is equal in importance. The second is inseparable from the first. So what Jesus does forever for people who are serious about following him is he links the love of neighbor with the love of God and forecloses on the possibility of claiming that you love God while you don't love your neighbor. That is a way of life issue, a way of life centered in love. And in the book, I talk about it as love for neighbor, love for self, because if we love our neighbors ourselves, we have to have the proper self-love. Love neighbor, love self. I think you have to love the earth because neighbor and self both depend on the earth. And in that context, when we speak of loving God, I think it's very different to love God in the context of a way of life centered in love than it is, you know, just in some kind of set of beliefs.
Yeah, it reminds me of that passage in 1 John that says those who say they love God but don't love their brother or sisters are liars.
Yeah, pretty strong
language. Pretty harsh language.
Yeah,
but that's true. Yeah,
but it makes it clear that the writer of that epistle certainly got Jesus' message and Paul's message, because Paul reiterates the same thing. And this is where, you know, it's been interesting, Adam, because of all the hate speech that's come up in this election season. A group of friends of mine and I started a little messaging campaign called We Stand With Love. If people are interested, you can just look up westandwithlove.org. And in the process of doing that, we found out that there was a group of scholars and activists, you know, these would be philosophers, political scientists, ethicists, who have started something called the Love Driven Politics Collective. And the idea is to say, isn't it about time that we bring the idea of love to bear on politics, both our political ends and our political means? And that to me is tremendously exciting. And that's exactly what I'm advocating for in the first third of this new book.
Yeah, one of my favorite passages in the book is where you talk about the nature of love. You state, you can't learn to love people without being around actual people, including people who infuriate, exasperate, annoy, offend, frustrate, encroach upon, resist, reject, and hurt you, thus tempting you to not love them. And I felt, Brian, that you were talking directly to me at this point. Especially in this point, as you've been talking about in American politics, but I'm living in this kind of tension, because you also talk rightfully a lot about the need to expose injustice.
Yeah.
And so when we have these kinds of conversations, can you help guide me through this tension of loving all people, especially as Jesus commands those we call our enemies, and exposing the injustice that we think our enemies are causing?
Yeah. Well, this is really, really important. And I think it as we take that question seriously, Adam, it's going to result in a whole new kind of activism. Because a lot of our activism in recent years involved demonizing our opponents, ascribing the worst possible motivations to their actions. I've been on the receiving end of this. I remember a few years ago, a book was written by a conservative Christian critic of mine, a very, you know, loyal critic. He wrote a book that was largely about me with a rattlesnake on the cover. That usually is not a good sign. I was allowed to see an early draft of the book before it was published. And the author said something like, you know, he disagrees with my interpretations of the Bible, and he even disagrees with the way I interpret the Bible. And the truth is, I disagree with him on both counts as well. But what he said is, it's obvious McLaren hates the Bible. Well, look, that's just not true. I respect the Bible. I've devoted my life in many ways to understanding it and communicating its message. And so it's just not true to say I hate the Bible, but it's very tempting, you know, it's very tempting when we disagree with someone to try to put all their motives, to put the worst spin we possibly can on their motives. What would happen if we did the opposite? What would happen if we tried to ascribe the best motives to the people we disagree with? We give them every benefit of the doubt we can. And in that spirit, we disagree. I think it might take a little longer, but it will produce fewer unintended negative consequences along the way. You know, this is part of what's so disturbing in this political campaign, when in your attempt to win, you actually poison the whole system. You make it harder for anybody to govern after the election is over. And we do something similar in our activist work. We have to find a way to even protest and disagree in a spirit of love.
Yeah. One of the parts about the book that I also really appreciate is where you talk about criticism and what you have learned about people who criticize you and what you can learn about yourself from those kinds of criticisms. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because criticism is something that's really hard to take.
Yeah.
And you have really helpful ways of doing it.
Well, first of all, if we're motivated by love to stand against injustice, and which I think we will be, I think Cornel West tells the truth when he says that justice is what love looks like in public. So when we're motivated by love, we stand up against injustice. It means we have to confront ideas. We have to confront systems. Sometimes we even have to confront people who are abusing power. And sometimes we have to do that by name, you know, very directly. When we do that, there will always be blowback. You know, there will always be criticism. Nobody, well, let's put it this way. Very few human beings in history have admitted they were wrong without a fight. Very few human beings in history have given up power without a struggle. Our egos, you know, they have that fight or flight response. And so they want to punch back when they're punched, you know. And this is why the message of Jesus is such a powerful message out of the mess we're in. He's inviting us to learn to turn the other cheek, you know, which is an act of courageous and confident resistance rather than revenge, punch back, or flee, you know, run and hide. So all that's to say that criticism is going to happen. And if we can, if we aren't careful, our response to criticism will discredit us far more than the criticism did. And that's why I think there's a kind of spiritual practice that is necessary for us to learn how to handle criticism graciously and not get caught in a kind of visceral cycle of reaction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really helpful. The second migration that you talk about is from a violent and exclusive view of God to a reconciling and harmonizing view of God. How has our violent and exclusive view of God led to such destruction?
Well, one of the interesting things that happened in the kind of anthropology of religious evolution is that we found a way to help religions create an us that's very strong. You know, if we all pray to the same God, if we all use the same language to refer to God, if we all follow the same rituals in referring to God, that creates a very strong sense of us. But then, either intentionally or unintentionally, anyone who's outside of our little circle of us is seen as them, as other, as dangerous, as less than. We're clean, they're unclean. We're saved, they're unsaved. We're orthodox, they're unorthodox. And that unning or that othering is a form of dehumanizing. And ultimately then, if you have reduced people, if you made them less than, I just was reading in this current political discourse, somebody was referring to immigrants as cockroaches, which is classic language. It was used in the Rwandan genocide. This is in the United States. Someone's referring to immigrants as cockroaches. Well, then if they're just insects, what's the problem with stamping them out or gassing them? You understand how that language has, how it evokes some of the worst moments of human history. So this tendency to dehumanize that is a byproduct of creating a very strong sense of belonging among the in-group of us. You see, this is a deep part of religion as it has been. And I think, you know, to use the language I'm comfortable with, I would say the Spirit of God is calling us to open our circle of us as big as all of humanity, to say all human beings are part of that us. And then I think even larger, all of life and this whole beautiful, fragile planet that's God's creation becomes one big, beautiful us.
Yeah. It reminds me of, you talk about the understanding of God and moving from like a God 1.0 to 2.0 to 3.0 to 4.0 to 5.0. And I found that really helpful because a lot of times when we make those kinds of moves, it can feel like, oh, those people are just stuck back at God 1.0 and we're so much further ahead at God 5.0 or 4.0 or whatever. But you have this beautiful way of saying, no, we need to incorporate all of these God 1.0 through God 5.0. We need to incorporate them together, include and expand all of them, which was really helpful. But as you go from God 1.0, which is kind of seeing God as parents when we're in our infancy, and God is just supposed to meet all of us at all of our needs, to God 5.0, which expands from this we mentality of just us and them to a we of everyone is included. I kept thinking how important that is to politics, and how a God 5.0 can help us move from something like a politics 1.0 to a politics 5.0.
Yep. Exactly right. And in this, and in a sense, what we're seeing, I think, is that this is the trajectory of human development. It's the trajectory in the Bible, I think, of egotism, narcissism, pure selfishness, to then saying, well, no, I have to be concerned about my family, you know, a larger circle. Oh, no, I also have to be concerned about my tribe or my nation. Oh, no, I have to be concerned about an even larger circle of all humanity. Oh gosh, I have to even be concerned about the soil and the bees and the trees and the climate and the sea, you know, that all of this is part of one interdependent community, an ecosystem that is all upheld by the love of the Creator. You know, I mean, to me, that's a deeply spiritual way of looking at life, and it's the trajectory to which we're called. But we often get stuck on various stages of the way there. So, you know, if I'm at that very narcissistic stage, anytime you get in my way, you're my enemy. It's me versus you at every moment, you know. But no, I think this is, you know, in one place in the New Testament, the Apostle Paul refers to the gospel or the essential message as the ministry of reconciliation, helping us bring people together in a larger whole.
Yeah. Adam and Brian, I've got a couple of questions in the chat room that might be a good point to bring in, if I could.
Yeah, excellent. Thank you.
Brian, Lacey from San Diego has a question about the evangelical community, particularly questions about dealing with racial issues among evangelicals, and whether she saw signs in the past and currently of authentic efforts to expand, if you will, the circle of inclusion. But is wondering if with Trump, do you feel, Brian, that there's a retreat from that good work?
I think there is a schism forming in evangelicalism right now, and I think it's not simply old versus young, but I think the younger and more educated evangelicals are, you know, deeply disturbed by the nativism and white privilege and white supremacy that Trump seems to you know, send out little signals about reinforcing. And through organizations like InterVarsity Christian Fellowship and the good work of people like Jim Wallace and Sojourners and Tony Evans, you know, sort of mainstream evangelicals who have tried to sensitize evangelicals to the latent racism that's so deeply embedded in all of white culture, including white Christianity. Now here's this other group that's retrenching, and it's a strange kind of deal that's been made, but somehow what older white evangelical leaders like Jerry Falwell Jr. and others have managed to do is, pardon the pun, but they managed to say that that outlawing abortion trumps every other concern. So it doesn't matter if you're concerned about race. It doesn't matter if you're concerned about the environment. It doesn't matter if you're concerned about how women are treated. The only thing that matters is getting Supreme Court justices who will outlaw abortion. Now, there are deep ironies about that project. We could talk about it if you'd like. But what it's done is it's made all the progress that some people have been making. I think, for example, the brilliant younger African-American evangelical named Lisa Sharon Harper, who's been doing great writing and speaking on this subject. A brilliant younger evangelical like Mark Charles, who's a Navajo, Native American, who has been speaking out about how Christianity was used to legitimize land theft and genocide against the Native peoples here. I mean, these are great strides of progress. And then all of that just gets washed away and pushed to the side by this promise about Supreme Court justices. To me, that's bad politics. It's bad morality. It's bad ethics. It's bad citizenship. But it sure works with some people who like a very simple kind of a shortcut to the moral high ground.
Mm. Well, that kind of leads into Tony's question. Tony Bartlett from Syracuse, Brian, is asking about the political campaign and if it's so poisoned that maybe politics isn't going to solve this crisis. Is there a kind of response that is actually deeply characteristic of Christianity that knows how to respond to such a root crisis, which I think you're referring to, these deeper cultural problems, or is it beyond help? And then he gives us a hint for an answer. Tony says, I'm thinking of things like monasticism or the early Franciscan movement as maybe offering verses.
So, Tony is, I'd love to hear what he'd have to say about this, because I know he's very thoughtful on these matters. Here's the thing. You can't give up on politics, because what politics means is how we organize our public lives, how we organize the intersections of our lives and our families with other families and our state with other states and our profession with other professions. As soon as we realize that there are boundaries where we have to negotiate across, we're dealing with politics. But at the same time, we can never think that politics is the only is the only ground that where these battles are contested or these negotiations are worked out, and frankly, this is maybe the deepest indictment we'd have to give of the American Christian community. As religious people have gotten more involved in the Republican Party, you know, the Republican Party made a very concerted effort to bring in white evangelicals and white conservative Catholics. As they did this, discourse, political discourse, became uglier. In other words, the role of religion did not lift up discourse. It made it easier to demonize people. And those demonizing tendencies of certain strains of religion then became more mainstream. In a way, it's only in certain conservative religious communities where women are still treated, theologically justified that they can't have equal rights to men. And it's no surprise then that when those religious sensibilities enter the world of politics, the progress of women toward equality is resisted, right? But here's the thing. You can't give up on religion either, because religion is how we organize our negotiations with existence, our negotiations with life and death and values and this creation and meaning. And so when we see crises in politics and crises in religion, we have to engage more deeply with both. We can't escape them. We're stuck with them as long as we're alive. But that, to me, is what I'm passionate about in this book, Great Spiritual Migration, and in the work of my life, is I think we have to dedicate ourselves more energetically and creatively than ever to a progressive and humane spiritual movement that will then influence business and influence family life and influence arts and creativity and influence politics and influence economics. That's where the engines of meaning in some ways are built in our spiritual lives, and then they can have an outflow into our culture at large. Sorry to ramble on, but it's a great question.
Yeah. Any more questions, Suzanne? Or okay. Yeah, I think that's it. Brian, you mentioned earlier that you love the Bible, but it's also clear in your book that you love Jesus. And Jesus, it seems to be, is the one who helps you move most especially from a violent view of God. You talk about the God embodied in Jesus as being different than the violent and exclusive God. Can you talk about more about Jesus? And, and then I'll have a follow-up question for that. Yeah.
Sure. Well, it's so interesting in this political campaign. It was interesting to watch Donald Trump say how he loves waterboarding and he thinks we need, I think his exact quote was, a hell of a lot worse than waterboarding to get where we want to go. Here's the irony. As Christians, we follow someone who was tortured but never tortured anyone else. We follow someone who, when he was being tortured, said, forgive them, which is a way of saying what they're doing is really wrong. They need to be forgiven for this, but I'm not going to say, let's go torture them back. Let's get revenge. So the very essence of Jesus' teaching, as well as the way he interacted with people, his lifestyle, as well as his way of, at the moment of his death, it all embodies an understanding of God that is nonviolent. And the Christian religion has not yet worked out whether we believe that God is indeed nonviolent. I advocate that it's time for us to grow up in this way, and it's time for us to actually become more fully Christian by acknowledging the nonviolence of God, the kindness of God, the compassion of God. And look, Islam is going through this too. Islam, one of the most beloved names of God is Allah the Compassionate, God the Compassionate One. But yet, I don't think in Islam there's been a way of dealing with what we might call Quranic texts of terror that would be parallel to biblical texts of terror. And so I just think it's time for our religious communities to grow up. And that's going to mean developing a grown-up way of reading the Bible so that we don't carry around scriptures that depict God as violent, as being absolute and unquestioned, unchallengeable. That's really important. You know, people who study brain science tell us that if you meditate on a compassionate understanding of God, you wire your brain in a more compassionate way. If you meditate on a vengeful and vindictive idea of God, you wire your brain in that way as well. And so the irony is that we become more like our God, whether that God exists or not. We become more like our image of God. And so this to me is one of the things I love about Jesus, is that he images the God who calls us beyond our current level of violence to greater harmony and love.
That makes a lot of sense to me. I have a Muslim friend who says every chapter of the Quran starts with, in the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And he tells me that every time he buttons up his shirt, he says, in the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And this is just like something that he does throughout his day when he's doing normal mundane activities. He repeats this mantra. And yeah, he's a very compassionate and merciful person. So that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Yeah, this to me is one of our great challenges at this juncture, and this election is holding up a mirror for us and helping us to see. And you know what's so ironic about this? I've been dealing with this for a long time. I remember decades ago when the big issue was, can women be ordained? And you know, I remember when I was an advocate for men and women being treated equally in all facets of life, including religion, you know, people telling me, you're going to hell, you're going to burn in hell. And it's so ironic that this impulse that's built in people is that a violent God is going to torture you unless you agree with me. I just think we have to become more truly Christian in understanding that's not what God is like, and neither should that be what we're like.
Yeah. You have a recent article out in On Faith, which relates to this Jesus issue. It's titled "Are Evangelicals at the Come to Jesus Moment? Let's Hope So." And that white evangelical Christians are Donald Trump's most dependable base. You write, they are so intoxicated by the cocktail of fear, winning, scapegoating, simple words, and big, unkeepable promises. They've sidelined the golden rule and the great commandment. And when we were talking with our historian, Bob Erickson, he said the same thing happened in Nazi Germany, this kind of sidelining the golden rule and the great commandment for a greater Germany. And I don't want to like start comparing Hitler and Trump. It's not fair to Nazi what happened in Nazi Germany. But you get the same, you're pointing to the same evangelical support of people who don't look very Christian. And I'm wondering if you can say something about that.
Well, look, Hitler never went around saying, elect me and we'll slaughter 6 million Jews, right? He didn't show his whole hand. He didn't show everything he was planning to do. So I think, you know, and this is true of many, many politicians, we have to take the signs they give us that tell us what their value system is, the signs they give us that tell us who they are. And then we have to say, you know, if the person gets more power, we should expect to see a lot more of that. And look, you know, if you or I or even Suzanne were running for president, you know, we all have our flaws, and those flaws could be very deeply exaggerated if we got more power. It's certainly true of Hillary Clinton. I mean, if what's really behind the email scandal, for example, is a desire for secrecy, then, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if Hillary is elected that we would see problems of secrecy. She's given us signs of that, right? But on the other hand, when I compare those dangers to the dangers of a guy who's, you know, talking about locking up his political opponents and all the rest, my gosh, when you reward someone who gives those signs with more power, you shouldn't be surprised at what you get as a result. And that's why, you know, many of us are working very, very hard to encourage people not to make that mistake.
I had a parishioner who was listening to NPR and a debate between a megachurch pastor and an evangelical professor. And the megachurch pastor said that he doesn't want anybody who looks like Jesus to be the president. And the government is supposed to be a strong man to protect its citizens against evildoers. When I'm looking for somebody who's going to exterminate ISIS, I don't care about the candidate's tone or vocabulary. I want the meanest, toughest son of a you-know-what I can find. And I believe that's biblical. And this gets back to the whole transformation of our understanding of God from violent to nonviolent. And also what to do about organizations like ISIS. I mean, Hillary Clinton wants to destroy ISIS too. But she leaves God out of it for the most part, right? But what are we to do about evil in our world?
Yeah. Well, look, I want to talk about ISIS in a minute, but I first want to say that megachurch pastor you quoted has no idea how foolish he is, has no idea how dangerous that use of the word biblical is. Look, genocide is in the Bible. In the middle third of my book, I talk about this in some detail, People can use the word biblical. Their Bible becomes like a loaded gun, or like and their theology becomes like a hand grenade, and all they need to do is pull the pin, you know. So talk about evil. There's some really evil stuff hidden in a word, can be hidden in a word like biblical. And we'd better get a lot more sophisticated about that. We've done so much damage already. It's time for us to get wise about our own past. But when you talk about ISIS, look, nobody has an easy answer for this, but my Buddhist friends have taught me something that I think there's a lot of wisdom to. There's a principle in Buddhism called the law of no independent origination. And what that means is that something cannot come into existence unless the conditions are right to bring it into existence. And when the conditions are right, that thing will be brought into existence. Something like ISIS comes about through certain conditions. And if we don't want it to exist in the future, you can drop bombs on it, but it will come back into existence in some new form if you don't deal with those conditions. Now, I think Buddhists express that in a very succinct and powerful way. I don't think that idea is missing from the Bible. In the Bible, it's called wisdom. And wisdom recognizes that if you set up a series of causes, if you sow certain seeds, you will reap the consequences. So if we want peace in the Middle East, then we have to have a greater sense of collaboration around the world to help create the conditions that will bring that will bring peace there. And wouldn't it be interesting if what the Spirit of God, if I can, you know, I'm speaking as a Christian, that's the language that makes sense to me, and it's what I see happening in the world. If the Spirit of God has brought us to a place where Christians and Muslims, the two largest religions in the world, 33 and 24% of the world's population, so well over half the world's population, what if we're at a place where those two religions actually need to start working together to create the conditions for peace, starting in the Middle East, but of course that spreads around the world? Look, it's either that, or it's what that megachurch pastor said, that we want to go back to the Middle Ages, to the era of strongmen, warlords, and so on. And this is where I just wish that we had a lot more pastors and preachers out there who were calling us forward, who were having a courageous moral voice, beckoning us on what I call a spiritual migration, calling us to move forward.
That gets to the third migration that I want to talk with you about, which is about evangelism and mission. Like most mainline Christians, when I hear these words, I get the shivers. But you have reframed it for me in a really helpful way. Can you talk about the importance of evangelism and mission?
Sure. Well, the third section of the book is where I talk about movement dynamics. And I think that it's time for Christian theology and other theological systems as well, but for Christian theology to start thinking about our work as movement work rather than just institutional maintenance. And so if evangelism means the spreading of good news, you know, what that's meant for a lot of people is going door to door or handing out tracts and saying, you're going to hell unless you join my religion, then you'll go to heaven. That's not what I'm talking about. But if I have good news to share, and that good news is that God's inviting us all into reconciliation, that the way of life that makes the most sense is the way of love. If I have that good news and all people are being invited into a way of life, which is a way of love, seeking the common good, I want to share that good news with everybody I can. If they want to change religions, that's fine. But in many ways, I would rather them stay as an agent of that love in their religion, you know, whatever it might be. So that's good news that I want to share. Another word for it is mobilization, mobilizing people to be spiritual activists or contemplative activists working for the common good. My gosh, what an exciting mission that is. I know that the traditional term evangelism and mission have a checkered history. And if people don't want to use those words, I wouldn't push them to. But that's why I'm using those words.
No, it makes great sense to me. Suzanne, you want to get Tony's last question in here?
Yes, I would. Thanks, Adam. Brian, Tony says you're an apostle of a sea change in Christianity. Have you seen evidence of this actually happening apart from yourself?
Boy, it reminds me of one of my mentors who said that his, speaking of mission, his mission was to reach Christians for Christ, beginning with himself. And sometimes beginning with ourselves is a big enough challenge. But here's what I would say. I would say there are signs of hope. Everywhere I go, people come up to me and say they get it. This is what they care about. I keep seeing creative young leaders starting new faith communities or people taking leadership in existing faith communities and leading in these positive directions. But here's the thing. I think a whole lot of us want to say, oh, good, the movement that we need is coming. We can all relax and watch another TV show and, you know, have another drink. I don't think that's the case. I think the signs of hope we see require each of us to become a spiritual activist and to throw our lot in for these things to become real in the on the scale that we need them to be. But I can just say I've been in something like, you know, between 40 and 50 countries in the last 15 years, and all around the world I see very promising signs of this happening. I guess the language of Jesus makes a lot of sense. You think it just takes a tiny bit of yeast to make the bread rise. And I think there's certainly enough yeast out there for that to happen.
It reminds me of one of the things that I really love about the Great Spiritual Migration is that you tell these stories of good people, of people doing good things in the world. And it's so easy, especially, I don't want to blame the media, but so often we get negative stories about how the world is coming to an end and it's just going awful. But you point us to the fact that there are good things happening in the world. And maybe to end, can you tell us about one of those stories, particularly one that gave me hope, about Dieter Vander?
Well, at the end of the book, with Dieter's permission, I told Dieter's story. Dieter was kind of a famous Christian celebrity, megachurch pastor, incredibly gifted guy, you know, just a really wonderful guy. And Dieter and I became friends back in 1998, I think it was. And after rising to some level of celebrity status in the Christian community, at a relatively young age, I've forgotten exactly his age, but I'm thinking it was maybe early to mid 40s, in his sleep one night, Dieter had a stroke. And he lost the ability to speak, and severe limitations came from that stroke. But over the following years, a couple of things happened. One is that a friend of his knew that he was a creative guy. He'd been a great musician and songwriter, as well as a gifted speaker. Someone said, well, he can't use words now the way he did before, but they gave him a camera. And he immediately, you know, the use of the camera became his creative outlet. And so that kind of reawakened and gave him some channel for expressing his creativity. And gradually, with a lot of work, he got some speaking ability back. But because of what he had had and what he lost and what he made of what was left, he has really deepened his spiritual life. And Dieter said two things last time we were together. He said one of the outcomes of his stroke is that he's learning to play with God. In other words, it's not about all this pressure. I've got to do all this stuff. But there's just the sense of I'm just a human being and I want to be at play with God. And the second he said, was that he realized now that everything is holy. It's that all of life is holy and of great spiritual value. And I wanted to end the book with Dieter's story because I think it creates the kind of spiritual vision that we need to be spiritual activists over the long haul in difficult times like these. We need to have some sense of rootedness that that we're working together in a spirit that's bigger than any one of us, and that the creation itself is so worth the struggle. That to me is the great gift, one of the many great gifts that Dieter has given me.
Yeah, and Brian, that might be a partial answer to this last question. Jim from Lake Oswego, Oregon is asking about fear, and he sees that as a motivator for a lot of behavior now, either conscious or subconscious. And I realize asking myself recently, what do I fear? I thought, I don't fear anything. And then I thought about it for a little while and the list got really long. But that is an aside for me. But Jim says, I see fear driving beliefs and policies. What do you have any recommendations for strategies for countering such fear?
Well, this is a great question. Look, fear is one of our motivators, you know, the problem is that that if we're over motivated by fear, we'll get into a whole lot of trouble, which is why one of the most common statements in the Bible is fear not. So I think what we have to do is allow foresight about potential negative consequences to be a factor in our decision making. That's the reasonable side of fear, but to not let this kind of primitive flight fight response that fear can kick us into to dominate. You know, in the book of Proverbs in the Bible, it constantly says that we have to dig down. We have to dig deep for wisdom. Wisdom's not on the surface. Wisdom is deeper. And what I would say is when we start feeling fear or when we see politicians using a lot of fear to try to get us on their side, in some way they're asking us, be afraid, trust me, and stop thinking for yourselves. And I think what we have to do at that point is say, no, I'm not going to surrender my wisdom to somebody else. I'm not going to outsource my conscience. I'm going to go more deeper than ever. I'm going to go deeper with people I trust. And we're not going to let fear become the drug that puts us in a kind of trance to take us dangerous places.
Well, Brian, that's a great way to end our chat. Thank you for being with us and spending this hour with us.
I really appreciate what you guys are doing. Keep up the good work with Raven Foundation. And to everybody who's been part of this, let's all of us not be afraid to speak up. You know, we've got online chats, but we also have lots of in real life chats with our relatives and our neighbors and our coworkers. Let's keep these conversations going.
Yes, definitely. Here at the Raven Foundation and the Raven Review, our tagline is change your view, change the world. And you have certainly changed our view today. So thank you for that. You can keep up with Brian on his website, brianmclaren.net, and on his Facebook and Twitter feeds. Anywhere else you want to send people to, Brian?
Nope, that's a good start right there.
Awesome. Thanks to everyone who joined us for the chat with your comments and questions. Next Friday, October 28th, we will talk with Asma Asfarudin about debunking the myths about Islam and violence. And the following Thursday, November 23rd, we will talk with Hannah Michaela about truth, lies, political scapegoating. For more information, please check out the Raven Foundation website and the Raven Foundation Facebook page. Thank you, everyone, and we hope to see you next week.